Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. As we move into Season 3, Chad and I will be talking about Ned's first small council meeting. Steve and I will be talking about Valar Dohaeris. One of the things I learned from your feedback was that you really love when we have medievalists on, and of course, Jenna Matthews is our go-to medievalist, and I thought, well, if people want more Jenna, let's give them more Jenna. So in Season 3, we're going to have Jenna Matthews on every week to answer a listener question. Of course, in order to make this work, we're going to need your help. Please email to book@baldmove.com if you have a question for Jenna. This can relate to a parallel to a character in Game of Thrones. Does that character have an analog in the medieval world? Or it can relate to customs or lifestyle in the medieval world. So, book@baldmove.com. Without further ado, here is medievalist Jenna Matthews. So, Jenna, the way that we did this initial recording, as you already know, but the listeners don't know, is that you sent me a list of 10 questions that you commonly get asked in your classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And I've chosen a few of those that I really like. And then what we did was a few of the emailers that expressed their undying love for you sent me a list of questions that they are interested in. So my thanks to Elizabeth and Leslie and Zara and Rebecca, who sent these initial questions just to kind of kick us off, get us started. Here's one that I liked. Did they have condoms in the Middle Ages?
Yeah, they absolutely did have condoms. We have some historical evidence and archaeological evidence of that. They were made out of intestines, usually of kind of animals, and sort of sewn together to make kind of a, you know, obviously a tube. You know, the effectiveness of said condoms, we are not really sure. You know, there was absolutely knowledge about how babies were made. So it wasn't like this sort of miracle gift from God. They knew that sex and that, ejaculation, it was in some way related to like the formation of a baby. And then if you could stop that, right, or prevent that from happening, then you also could prevent pregnancy.
Yeah.
So we don't, you know, because those materials disintegrate over time, we don't, there's not a lot of like written record about them, but yeah, they did use them to whatever sense of efficacy. We were not entirely sure.
And I'm willing to go out on a limb here and say that Robert Baratheon either didn't know about these or he just wasn't a big fan.
Yeah, I mean, like in a culture where, kids are economic goods and they're, you have children in order to help like work on the farm, or you have them for social status in the case of high ranking individuals, or because you need an heir and a spare, and like in some with a high mortality rate,
right,
10 spares, then, you know, there may be lots of reasons why you wouldn't want to practice or have contraception.
Just the phrase, an heir and a spare, kind of shows you how children were something of a commodity.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I think it doesn't diminish a parental love for their children. And I think that that's also a misconception is that just simply because by having so many and then having them die so frequently must have meant that parents didn't care for their kids.
Yeah,
and I think that, you know, people are people, and, we'd like to think that, and we have lots of evidence to suggest that the parents did love their children, but, you know, for sure, like, I think if you were in a position where it was in your vested interest to have your family line preserved and was necessary, then you needed to have a lot of kids just to play the odds.
And I'm just kind of guessing here, because, you know, this is sort of pre-scientific revolution, that the purpose of the prophylactic would be to hinder baby making, and they wouldn't have had any idea that this would actually stop the spread of disease or anything.
Yeah, really no concept of that. I think that this is, syphilis was rampant throughout the Middle Ages, and so, you know, but syphilis was also typically associated with women and women's morality. And so it was never or very rarely thought of as something that men passed on and that they were potential carriers. And we know that obviously syphilis can be passed on from females to males, but and vice versa. But it's not necessarily a spread of disease, like sexually transmitted diseases or just disease in general they knew that they existed, but it was largely a problem of female morality and sin, as opposed to.
So it was
to,
really kind of a superstitious and misogynistic explanation for where syphilis came from.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Chad, just like Ned Stark, weary off the road, I put it upon you to record this podcast directly after you got back from a trip.
Yes. I think you were actually pressuring me before I left for the trip.
I know. I was.
And no, I really like coming on, and
you are a little like Ned and I am a little like Varys.
that right? You have a sickly sweet smell like flowers on a grave.
There are so many ways that I'm not like Varys, but there are so many ways that I am that I just kind of, I kind of try to see past Varys's grossness from time to time, because I enjoy the things about him, certain things about him. That
do you use powder on your skin?
I don't use powder, and I don't smell like roses on a grave or whatever.
Do you wear slippers?
Sometimes. I was wearing slippers last night.
You're not that much like Varys, man.
Sure I am. Yeah.
I think that's who you said you were like, right? When you answered the question who you were most like, you said you were like
Varys. No. I said that when other people see me, they see me as Varys.
Uh-huh.
Deep down I know that I'm an Arya style ninja.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I do keep my cards close.
Mm-hmm.
I do, because I'm an introvert, I can put on sort of a personable affect for political strategy. That's just being a good office mate, I think.
Oh, come on. Sure. Deep down, you are a sweet guy. That's what I think.
I think that I'm just really good at fooling you on this.
No way. That's how good I am.
Those are my Varys skills.
There's layers and layers and layers, and there is maybe a layer where you're pretending, but then underneath that, maybe there's a mean layer, and then underneath that still, there's a sweet layer. You can't trick me. I've known you too long.
Maybe. Well, you know, we have moments.
Yeah.
So yeah, I appreciate you coming on. Now, one of these days, we're going to do an Ed chapter, and it won't be Chad Carmichael, and people are gonna lose it. I'm going to get all kinds of emails, because I think people have come to expect that Professor Carmichael will be.
Well, I heard you talking about, you know, the show, and you had taken, you had solicited some emails from listeners. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And good response, and I appreciate all of the feedback.
I really didn't know if I was an academic or a super fan, because I'm not very academic in my appearances.
Well, here's what would make you an academic. So you're a professor, and you're a professional thinker, so you're going to bring something different than like a super fan would bring. However, unlike many other guests who I've had on here, usually the professors that I find to talk about this stuff have either like they've written an essay on Game of Thrones, or they've taught a class on Game of Thrones and I found their syllabus online or something like that. In that way, you are a super fan, because you are such a serious man. You would never like teach a class like Introduction to Philosophy through Game of Thrones or something like that.
I don't know. I might. I mean, I've taught Intro to Philosophy through Film and used popular films for that. And I think it's a really good way, actually, to do an Intro to Philosophy course. I'm not opposed to that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I see a lot of philosophical content in these books.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can always find something. I mean, if you scratch deep enough, but...
Well, I will say this. The one class that I taught that was sort of philosophy adjacent, which was an ethics class,
mm-hmm.
I did use Game of Thrones. I think that there are ethical discussions to be had.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose that might be right. Stemming I don't teach a lot of ethics, so.
So, and you were one of the people that helped me think through how to teach that class.
Oh, I don't even remember that.
Yeah, this was back when I was at University of the Pacific, and you explained to me in very simple terms the difference between deontology and consequentialism.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I argued, and I continue to argue, that Ned is a great example of deontology.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
That Varys is a great example of consequentialism.
Oh, you think so? I find him so mysterious that it's hard for me, even after you've read through the existing books, I still find him somewhat of a question mark.
Well, I think that he presents himself to Ned at the end of A Game of Thrones as someone who's a consequentialist in that he says, look, it doesn't matter what's true. Lie. Say that you tried to take the throne. You'll get to take the black, and you'll get to save your children's lives.
Right.
Look, it's the consequences of this decision that are important. It's not it's not the code you're trying to live up to.
Right.
And in the end, Ned agrees to take Varys's plan.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work out.
Right. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't.
The one time Ned decides to, well, I shouldn't say the one time, but Ned does decide to depart from his code, and things go as bad as you could imagine.
Ned, you know, Ned thinks he's duty bound, but it's probably a little bit true that he's fooling himself.
Well, I think that here's what you have to add to the mix. This is where it gets really complicated, because Ned is very tribal.
Yeah.
Right? I think that truly a true deontologist would have to kind of have this idea of what the tribe has taught, mm-hmm. but then create an abstract, like, good. And live up to that abstract good, where sometimes if you're truly tribal, it's like, yeah, but... what's my wife going to think about that? Or you're going to make a decision that you think is for the good of the tribe.
Right.
That sort of steps away from the abstraction of the ideal.
Right, right.
So I feel like in his heart of hearts, he strives to be a deontologist.
Yeah, maybe a kind of low deontologist whose duty is primarily to his tribe.
Yeah.
sort of these institutions that don't really deserve his.
Where would you put Kant on this? I would put Kant as a high deontologist.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sort of paradigmatically, he is a deontologist.
Famously, he would say something like, you know, it is never okay to lie.
Yeah, yeah. Something people like really that. Dislike that view of his. Yeah, I think, he, you know, literally, if the old example is, you know, the Nazis come to the door and you're hiding Jews or something, like, he would say you can't lie.
Yeah, you can't lie. What would he say to, like, a true statement that's meant to deceive? Like, to say, like, yeah, like, laugh it off. Like, yeah, we've got, like, 2 dozen up in our attic right now. You know, really dripping with sarcasm.
Yeah, what would Kant actually
say
to
that?
I don't know. I'm not well-versed enough in the theory to say.
Okay. All right. So I feel like I ought to do a synopsis of this chapter. This is Ned's fourth POV chapter. Here's my synopsis. Ned arrives in King's Landing 2 weeks after the direwolf incident with Joffrey. He's exhausted from the road, but he's put upon to attend a small council meeting right away. He meets Varys, Littlefinger, Pycelle, and Renly. He learns that Robert has called for an expensive tournament and, more importantly, that the crown is in debt to the tune of 6 million gold dragons. Ned leaves in a huff, trying to make sense of the situation, but Littlefinger hijacks the rest of his day. Baelish claims that Kat is in the city, and so Ned, albeit wary and weary, follows. After a climb down a rock face and a ride to the brothel, Ned finds that Kat really is waiting for him. He learns of the intrigue at Winterfell, the knife, the supposed Lannister plot, puzzles over it all. Littlefinger promises to help, to which Ned concedes. He tells Kat to return to the north without seeing the girls. Chad Carmichael, do you want to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I just climb the ladder of chaos?
I'm going to pass on the ladder this time.
Mm-hmm.
Pass.
People are, is the ladder is becoming, the ladder is kind of like, it's so 2020.
No, I don't agree. I think you should have Ladder of Chaos merch.
I think we need to get rid of the ladder.
You need t-shirts and mugs that have the Ladder of Chaos.
All right, so you're going to pass on
the ladder. I am not going to climb it today. I am not. I have a specific question.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, you know, Ned has just shown up in King's Landing.
I'm going to pause you right there. I want to go meta for a second.
Okay.
Is it possible to climb the Ladder of Chaos? Because Littlefinger seems to think that chaos is a ladder. I think of it like a pile of rubble. And you might be able to climb, but it's not a ladder. And you might die. You might die trying to climb the rubble.
I always picture being on a halfway up a very long ladder. And it's on fire. That's always what I picture.
Oh, it's yeah. All right.
So I don't know whether to go up or down. I'm afraid I'm going to fall to my death.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I don't know how much longer before my hands are going to get burned and I can't keep climbing. That's how I picture it.
Yeah, I don't even think that. I mean, I think Littlefinger does okay climbing the Ladder of Chaos, but I think that he's better at creating chaos. And, like, he's hit or miss on benefiting from chaos.
For all the reputation that he has as some sort of evil genius,
mm-hmm.
I am just entirely unimpressed by Littlefinger. In this chapter, I'm unimpressed by him. And it's sad that I'm even less impressed by Ned and Kat in this chapter.
I'm pretty impressed by Littlefinger. But let's wait and let's save that for... Let's tease that for later in the podcast.
Okay, so my question is, Ned just has just arrived
uh-huh.
in the thick of things here, right?
Right.
And he gets to the city. Immediately, he's drawn into a small council meeting. He doesn't even have time to get his own clothing, so they have to put him in some borrowed clothes.
Yeah.
He's clearly just a fish out of water right from the get-go. He's clearly throughout the chapter trying to get his feet under him. My question is, what should Ned have done in the wake of what happened in this chapter? What should he be thinking? What should he be planning?
Are you talking about the small council or are you talking about what he's learned in the brothel?
Both. So this all happens in the course of, you know, I take it in the course of about a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of his first picture of what's happening here, mm-hmm. At the center of things. And I just think he makes terrible, terrible decisions. And here's what I want to suggest. I think Littlefinger gives Ned every reason not to trust him, not to trust Littlefinger.
Okay.
What is Ned clearly seeing here? He clearly sees that there's a big financial crisis. Littlefinger is the master of coin, so he has to hold some responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm.
And Littlefinger, from the beginning to the end of the chapter, repeatedly insults and humiliates Ned.
Yeah.
and is clearly making some kind of moves on his wife on top of everything else. And just comes across as a guy who is clearly not trustworthy. So here's what I actually think. Okay.
Yeah.
I actually think if I'm trying to get my mind, you know, I'm trying to get myself into Ned's shoes. So I'm not thinking the way I think, right? I wouldn't do things that people do in the Game of Thrones world. But my first thought was, it kind of seems like Ned should kill him right there in the brothel.
How much of this is you retrograding some of your knowledge about what will happen?
So, good point. It's possible that is what's going on. But
I mean, by the way, when Trip Fuller was on, he suggested something similar, like Cat should just kill him right there.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, like, Littlefinger is clearly an uncouth man. He's a man without honor. He's a man who is opportunistic, and he's kind of an ass, right?
Right.
Does any of that warrant immediate death?
So here's what I'm thinking. Ned can see pretty quickly that Robert is in trouble, that the kingdom is in trouble.
Uh-huh.
There's this financial crisis. It's pretty clear to him that John Arryn, is that how you say his name? Arryn or Arryn?
I say Arryn, but I've heard people say Arryn. Honestly, it does. Name pronunciation doesn't trouble me as it does some okay. others in the fandom.
Anyway, that guy, yeah. he's, you know, Ned thinks he's been murdered. Ned thinks it's the Lannisters who murdered John, but he doesn't really know who all is involved, and he doesn't know who he can trust uh-huh. on the small council. To my way of thinking, he should be looking at the situation as he comes into the small council. He should be thinking, okay, who's on the small council? It's Renly, Stannis, Selmy, right?
Barristan the Bold. Yep. Varys, Littlefinger, and Pycelle.
Right. And so if I'm Ned, I'm looking at that group and thinking, okay, I need a small council I can trust. I think he can probably just needs to decide that he's going to trust the Baratheons. His life is just sort of bound up with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that means Stannis and Renly and of course Robert are going to be Ned's trusted people. I think Barristan the Bold, right, is a good bet for Ned. I think Ned should probably size him up as a guy that can be trusted. The rest of them are really questionable, right?
All right. Pause right there. We've had lots of discussions about Robert's character.
Yeah.
So I think that Ned can trust Robert to be Robert.
Yeah.
But I don't know that he can trust Robert in the way that he would need to trust Robert to do what needs to be done.
Fair enough. I mean, I think...
And on top of that, he thinks that Renly is kind of a, you know, Robert Jr., like, you know, Robert come sure. again or something. So I don't know how much Ned can really trust Robert. Not because Robert would do something to like betray Ned, but that Robert always does things to betray himself.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you that Robert has to be managed. I mean, everybody's constantly trying to manage Robert, right? But I think Ned can trust him in the sense that, you know, if he's well managed and Ned makes careful use of his friendship with Robert, then he can count on Robert to do a few things. I don't think it would be useful for Ned to go to Robert and say, hey, you know, we really need to rein in the spending. I don't think that's going to work. But, you know, maybe what he can do is say Ned can make some moves. And if Robert complains, Ned can say, look, you want me to go back to Winterfell? Because I can just resign and go back to Winterfell. And I think that's a play he can make with Robert. And I think Robert would tolerate a certain amount of that and wouldn't try to undermine Ned or hurt him.
Well, eventually Ned does try to do that. I think that's the nuclear option.
Yeah.
Like to resign and go back to Winterfell, which eventually Ned does try to do that.
Right.
But it can't be done for like a tournament of the hand. It has to be, you have to save the nuclear option for like, oh, you want to kill a child. All right.
Yeah.
That's where I'm out. You know, that is Ned's red line. Right. So
I just think, okay. So you asked me, am I depending on things I know from reading later in the books.
Yeah.
And I don't think so, because I think Ned has every reason to distrust the Lannisters. In fact, he probably has more reason to distrust them than is ultimately correct, right? Because he believes things about the Lannisters that aren't true. Like he thinks the Lannisters killed Jon Arryn, and it turns out not to be the case, right? But he has reason to distrust the Lannisters. He finds out Littlefinger, the master of Coin, has put the kingdom in debt largely to the Lannisters. Littlefinger is self-evidently not trustworthy.
I think that you're blaming Littlefinger for Robert's sins.
I think I'm blaming the Master of Coin, at least in part, for a $6 million, not dollar, dragon.
You should be, all right, so blame Jon Arryn. Jon Arryn is allowing Robert to beggar the realm, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Jon Arryn turns to the Master of Coin and says, yeah, let's do it anyway. At what point do those two guys, should those two guys be blamed for the situation? Littlefinger is the immoral creature that they've decided to have do their dirty work. You know, he's the guy, but I don't know if that's who I don't know that if he's to blame for that.
So, okay. So forget about blame. He's at least a facilitator of this financial crisis.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
And to the great benefit of the Lannisters, who Ned has every reason to think of as villains. So if I were Ned, I would be thinking after the small council meeting, I would be thinking, Littlefinger's out. I can't trust him. Now, that's when Littlefinger starts leading him down to the brothel and repeatedly insulting his intelligence and humiliating him and calling him old. And saying things about his wife and acting like little.
Telling him to fondle breasts in the brothel.
And I have to say, I mean.
He's just full of great advice.
I didn't really understand why Ned didn't just kick his rear end.
I think he probably would have if Roderick hadn't interceded.
Yeah.
He probably would have. I think, okay, here's. Let me frame it like this. Do you remember how in Fellowship Strider is introduced for the first time?
Yeah.
He's introduced as this sort of shady character who's kind of sitting in the shadows and he's sort of creepily observing the hobbits. And Frodo is like asking about him, like, who's that guy and why is he looking at us? And I'm not sure if I can trust him, right?
Right.
Tolkien is being subversive in his own way. Like, here's the hero of the story, but don't trust your eyes. This guy is actually probably the most trustworthy guy in Middle Earth. but your eyes will deceive you. He's gonna look like a villain, but he's really your ally.
Right.
I think that with Littlefinger, it's kind of like he, on the surface, he absolutely looks like a villain. Like he's being a jerk. He's like, he's beggaring the realm. He's being flippant or whatever. And in the end, Ned thinks, but he is Catelyn's old friend, and I do need to ally with someone. So maybe I shouldn't trust my eyes here. Maybe I should trust, like, that Cat sees something in him that I just can't see. What Martin is doing is he's saying, nope, there's another level. He looks evil. His motives actually are toward Cat, which seem like, okay, that's pure. But underneath it all, he's actually evil. So there's like three levels. And Ned's not a three-level guy.
Right. Well, but Ned should be able to tell a few things. Ned should be able to tell after the small council meeting, Littlefinger has at least facilitated this crisis. And we need someone in that position who will help me get us out of the crisis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's not going to be Littlefinger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, number two, Littlefinger, I can't, at least you could see that you're not sure whether you can trust him.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I really need someone other than Littlefinger in that position. I really can't tell if I can trust Littlefinger. Yes, I do have to trust somebody, but you know who that somebody is going to be? It's going to be the Baratheons and Barristan. Those are going to be the people that I'm choosing to trust.
Yeah, I get it. I hear what you're saying.
Finally, I don't like this guy. He has to be thinking, right? I don't like him. I don't like the way he talks to me.
Yeah.
I don't like the way he acts toward my wife. And so I just, his decision, oh, I think I'm just going to trust Littlefinger.
Uh-huh.
It's like the stupidest choice. It just doesn't make any sense. It's almost like he just wants to punish himself. It's like he thinks, and it says that in the chapter, right? He says something like, what does he say? Where is it in here? I can't find it in here.
Okay, I'm going to read it.
Okay.
At least I'm going to read what I think that you want me to read.
Right.
It was true enough that they needed help, and Littlefinger had been almost a brother to Cat once. It would not be the first time that Ned had been forced to make common cause with a man he despised.
That's so stupid.
I want to ask you about that. I finished what you were going to say, but I want to ask you about that.
It's like he's maybe one of these kind of, he's got this kind of Puritan instinct, right? Where whatever the most miserable, the most unpleasant course of action would be for him personally, that must be the right thing. That's not, he's not thinking clearly here. What he should be thinking is, oh no, Kat, you told him that we suspect the Lannisters. I don't know if he's in league with the Lannisters. What I do know is that he's facilitated a debt that benefits the Lannisters. And now you've told him this. Before that moment, I would actually think he shouldn't kill Littlefinger. But it's at that moment that I think maybe he needs to kill Littlefinger.
How is any of this worthy of death?
Because if he goes and tells the Lannisters that they suspect, war will likely break out. And indeed, that's in fact, I think, what Littlefinger probably wants. Mm,
I see. And we know that Ned is aware that the events leading up to this require some sort of war planning anyway, right?
Right, right. I just want to repeat as well. I mean, you know, this is it's a sad world and a horrible system where you come into a situation like this and you start thinking about murdering a guy.
Your first day at the office, like you're just meeting new people.
Yeah, this is the darkness of this story, is it makes you think these things. But yeah, I mean, I think his best play, what would be best for the realm and for the kingdom and for Robert, who he serves, his friend, I think what would be best for all those things is for him to either. So I think there's actually kind of a fork in the road here. I can think of two ways to handle Littlefinger. One is he could just kill him.
Yeah.
And the benefit of that would be not only all the things I've already mentioned, but also it would sort of send this message, or it would give this impression of Ned as being kind of, you know, the rumor would be that he killed Littlefinger out of jealousy because Littlefinger was moving on his wife or something, right? And maybe that would be an impression, a false impression, I think, that Ned could exploit in some way or other. Mm. The other way he could deal with Littlefinger is he could just not kill him and take note of the fact that Littlefinger has made it clear that he's at odds with Varys, and approach Varys to find out what Varys thinks about what should be done about Littlefinger.
I think he hates Varys even more than Littlefinger.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think what he should be thinking, though, is he should be thinking Varys and Littlefinger are both big problems because I can't trust either one of them, and I don't really understand what's motivating either one of them. And so the other thought, if he's not going to kill Littlefinger, he should approach Varys with the idea of figuring a little bit more out about Varys.
I think you're being very hasty, Chad.
I think Varys is a big problem, you know, from Ned's perspective.
I think that Ned doesn't know who to trust. I don't think that anyone on that small council is trustworthy. I think that it's a very small, he wants to keep the people who know what he knows to be a very small circle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he has to necessarily trust Littlefinger, but I think he has to at least try to use him to find out more information.
Well, Littlefinger knows that he's
now Ned's not in his league. Ned is not in Littlefinger's sort of league in terms of intrigue. And I think he knows that about him. But at this point, it's like,
that's another reason to kill him.
Hmm.
I mean, what would happen if he killed Littlefinger? Littlefinger doesn't really have that much power.
Here's the power that Littlefinger has over Ned. I think Littlefinger knows that he can poke and prod Ned as much as he wants because Kat views Littlefinger as a brother.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going to kill his wife's brother.
Yeah.
You know, normally, Chad, you bring something good to the table. I'm really kind of disappointed.
Yeah. So you're saying that So here's what's going on. I was a little irritated with Kat. I think it was really stupid that she told Littlefinger about their suspicion. And so I was sort of discounting what she thought, you know.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, you know, Ned's married to her and he loves her. And
moreover, this is her world more than it is his. And I think that sometimes, like, he trusts Kat. I think he ought to trust Kat.
Yeah.
And she is more of a political animal of the South than he ever will be. And I think that, I mean, Littlefinger kind of outwits them both. And in hindsight, I think you're probably right. He needs a good knife to the throat or whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't think that we can call Ned stupid for not killing him right then and there.
Yeah, I don't think it's stupid that he didn't kill him. I just think that he might should have done that.
Yeah. All right, let me ask you my question.
It's stupid that he trusted him.
Okay, is it stupid that Frodo trusted Gollum?
Did Frodo trust Gollum?
That's my question. I think that Littlefinger is very much a Gollum character here, where it's like, look, I can trust Gollum in so much as I have power over him because I know he's addicted to the ring.
Mm-hmm.
So I can trust Gollum to act like Gollum, and I can use that. And I think that maybe that's how Ned should have approached Littlefinger. It's like, look, as long as he thinks he's getting something out of this, then I can trust that he's going to act in terms of his own ambition. But I'm never going to really trust him.
Can Ned just expel Littlefinger from the small council?
I'm sure he could. I'm sure if that's what he wanted to do, I'm sure
he Here's could. The problem, though. He can't, because Littlefinger now knows from Kat that they suspect the Lannisters. So if he tries to if he tries to do that, then the Lannisters will be brought into the mix.
I see. I think so. You're right. He knows too much. He knows too much. And now you know what Littlefinger knows? He did not learn from Ned. So by the time Ned enters this picture, Littlefinger already has to be on the inner circle or killed. Those are the only two options for Littlefinger, right? And you're saying kill him.
Yeah. Or here's the secret alternative that I mentioned before, right? You could go to Varys, thinking to yourself, well, I need to find out more about Varys anyway. And I know now that Littlefinger and Varys are at odds with each other. So maybe I'll go to Varys. I'll poke him a little bit and see what he comes out with. And maybe Varys, being some sort of genius that he is, right? Maybe he'll have an idea how to handle Littlefinger.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe Ned will be convinced that he has to decide to trust Varys, which is
that's all the more improbable. He hates Varys. Is the guy that looks like benign on the surface, but you know that he's really dangerous deep down. On top of that, Kat is completely afraid of Varys.
Yeah.
I would much rather trust someone who is like kind of openly uncouth.
Yeah.
On the surface and you know, maybe concealing, you know, a sweet spot for Kat or something.
Littlefinger brags that he has control over Varys. What is that about?
I have a different question for you. I will absolutely talk about that, but I want to ask you this question first.
Okay.
It would not be the first time that Ned had been forced to make common cause with a man he despised.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the man that he despised previous to Littlefinger?
Roose Bolton?
He keeps Roose Bolton at arm's length.
Yeah, but it's just Bolton is one of his guys, right?
Well, he's a banner man, right?
Yeah. They have common cause.
I don't remember those two making common cause together.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know what this is talking about. I don't know if I should know at this point.
Right.
But I don't know if Martin ever really reveals this.
I mean, maybe he sees the Lannisters as being kind of like that.
Jaime Lannister. He had to make common cause with Jaime.
Yeah.
And we know he does not. Jaime was a kid or whatever. But eventually he has to kind of ally himself with Tywin and Jaime and all those folks who turn on the Targaryens in order to overthrow the Targaryens.
Yeah.
I could see that being the case. I wondered if you had puzzled over that as well.
Yeah, no, I missed that when I was reading it last night, but my best guess is either he's thinking of Bolton or the Lannisters.
So you had a question about Varys. What does Littlefinger have over Varys?
Yeah.
Well, we know that Littlefinger is, he's not to be trusted, right?
Yeah.
So he could just be lying. He could just be like boasting to Kat. Like,
right.
The person that you must fear, don't be afraid of him. I've got right. his metaphorical balls in my hand. So it could be that he doesn't really have much over Varys, or maybe he knows that Varys is kind of colluding. That's one of my favorite words now. Colluding with Ilario.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the only thing that I can think of. Eventually, it is revealed that Varys has got some kind of, I'm not going to say treasonous, but he's got some kind of underhanded relationship with Ilario.
Yeah, yeah, right. So, okay, so that's interesting, because if Ned goes to Varys and Varys knows that Littlefinger knows about Ilario, then Varys is not going to want to move against Littlefinger.
Well, at least Varys is extremely cautious.
Yeah.
Littlefinger, he plays things out and, you know, he makes things happen. But I kind of get the feel that sometimes he'll like light a stick of dynamite under like a load bearing wall.
Yeah.
Just to see how the thing collapses.
Right.
And then thinks, OK, how can I make use of this? Where I don't think Varys is that kind of guy. I think Varys collects information, and sometimes he'll use it, sometimes he won't, but he does. He's not going to do anything unless he thinks he knows what the outcome is going to be.
So the more I think about this, the more I'm convinced that for Ned, the smart move is to kill Littlefinger. And here's the basic reason. He can't really depend on Varys. he needs Littlefinger off of the small council in order to get control of the financial situation. He can't trust Littlefinger. And Littlefinger now knows about the Lannisters. Ned should be expecting that at some point there's likely to be war with the Lannisters. He should be worried that Littlefinger will sort of cause that to happen prematurely. For all these reasons, he should see Littlefinger as his number one problem if he's really paying attention. And I don't see a way to deal with Littlefinger other than taking him out. So that's my case. That's it.
It's hard to argue with you because we know what's going to happen to Ned.
But I'm arguing based on things that Ned should have on the front of his mind. There's a financial crisis. Littlefinger knows destructive secrets. I don't have anybody that can help me with Littlefinger because he's got dirt on the people that might be able to help me. These are all things that Ned should have on the front of his mind.
Do you think that Ned should send Kat back to Winterfell?
Yeah, with his daughters.
Because I was just thinking, if he can't trust Varys, he can't trust Littlefinger, maybe he should keep Kat around. Have someone he can trust in the city that maybe other people will underestimate or something like that. Because right now he doesn't really have anyone.
It's too dangerous. He needs to send his wife and his daughters back to Winterfell. He made the right move ordering that the North be fortified. And he needs to recognize that the people he has to trust, as sketchy as it is, he has to trust Renly and Stannis. That's it. That's my view. That's what Ned should be thinking. But he's not very good at this. So
he's not. And on top of that, he kind of knows that about himself.
And it's weird.
He's self-aware about this. There's a couple times in this chapter where the word game is mentioned. And I mean, because it ends up being on the cover of the book, it kind of stands out to me. But in both cases, it's Ned thinking like these guys in this small council, they really enjoy playing this word game.
Right.
And I just hate it. I would rather give me a sword. I would rather face any of these idiots in the melee or whatever.
See, that's what I'm suggesting, is that he should say enough of these words and run Littlefinger through with his sword.
And then later on, he notices that Littlefinger is better at this game of intrigue. Like, he says it's like meat and mead for him. Like, he eats it up. He loves it so much. And Ned just despises. It's almost like he despises anyone who will engage in that kind of intrigue. So he knows, he's at least self-aware enough to know that he is out of his league.
Yeah.
When it comes to the game.
Would Kat forgive him for killing Littlefinger?
I think she'd have to. I think she would. Eventually she would have to. And I think that she distrusted Littlefinger.
Yeah.
And then he seemed like he was genuinely wanting to help her. And so then she decided, like, I'm going to trust you. And I think that a lot of times what ends up happening is, like, when you reconcile with someone, you tend to want to forget the things that made you distrust them in the first place.
Right.
And you tend to try to bring up memories where you had that same feeling of trust.
Yeah.
And so she ends up calling him, you know, the brother, my long-lost brother or whatever.
Yeah.
Chad, I know that you think that Ned should kill. I don't think Ned has enough information to warrant cold-blooded murder.
Well, part of the problem here is that I don't really know how to think about kind of the rules of when it's reasonable to kill someone in this universe. That's part of my problem.
Like, if it was like out in the courtyard and Littlefinger, you know, spat in his face and called his wife a cow, then it'd be like, all right, yeah, everyone's fine with him killing him now. But it's like, it's in a brothel and it's like, I can't let you live, you know too much. Then people would be kind of look side eye at it.
Oh, no, I think he would just sell the killing as due to Littlefinger's disrespect and mistreatment, you know. Moving on his wife and stuff. That would be totally believable.
He put my wife in a brothel. Of course I'm going to kill him.
Right.
I just don't I just don't see that in Ned's character. I think if Ned did that, I would be complaining like, no, that's Ned Stark. He's not going to do that. He feels guilty over killing the direwolf. He's not going to kill a guy for treating him badly.
He certainly needs Littlefinger off of the small council. That's the basic observation here.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. And he can't do it because he knows too much.
Yeah.
He could promote Littlefinger. Mm-hmm. He could say, you know what? I'm going to give you all of this land.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a castle, and here's, you know, your new bride or something.
Send him off to the Eyrie or something. That's where he's angling to get, right?
Something. I mean, you could buy him off. You don't have to kill him. You could use maybe his ambition against
him. Maybe that's right.
Him.
Maybe that would be better. It's just with him knowing as much as he does, you would have to really be worried about him.
So here's a good question. What would Tyrion do if he was in Ned's situation? Because I don't think that Tyrion would kill Littlefinger.
It's such a difficult question because Tyrion is a Lannister and his allegiance to his family is a big part of how he makes decisions.
Yeah, that's true.
So you're trying to imagine Tyrion as a Stark, which is a really weird thing to try to imagine.
It is odd. It is odd.
I mean, but in a way,
but
that's
I do think
question.
That Tyrion would do something like that, where he would like use Littlefinger's ambition against him.
Right. I mean, I think maybe if you're going to go that route, like you're sort of describing carrots that you can use on Littlefinger, but you also need a stick. You know? You need something on Littlefinger. And I think that the problem there is that Littlefinger is very good at protecting himself in that way. You know, I think it would be very difficult to get compromising information about Littlefinger.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I've got a different topic that I think is adjacent to this chapter.
Sure.
And this is something that's going to perplex, I think, show-only listeners. So I had to find this passage. It's in A Storm of Swords. It's Jaime's 9th POV chapter. Jaime and Cersei are talking about what happened to Bran. You know, we're talking about the whole cat's paw incident, right? So I'll read this little section. Cersei frowned. Joffrey had no love for Robb Stark, but the younger boy was nothing to him. He was only a child himself. And then Jaime says this to Cersei. He says, a child, speaking of Joffrey, a child hungry for a pat on the head from that sot you let him believe was his father. He had an uncomfortable thought. Tyrion almost died because of this bloody dagger. If he knew the whole thing was Joffrey's work, that might be why. And then there's an ellipsis there, and his thoughts trail off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, clearly, in A Storm of Swords, we find out that Jaime thinks that Joffrey did it.
Yeah.
So my take on this has always been, well, Jaime doesn't know. He just thinks it was Joffrey. But what Jaime thinks are his motives don't really track in my mind. Here's what Jaime thinks. Jaime thinks Joffrey doesn't really know anything about Bran, but he thinks he can impress Robert if he has Bran killed. That's what Jaime thinks. And I'm thinking, this makes no sense at all.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
This doesn't make any sense at all. So I don't feel like I can trust Jaime's point of view on this one.
Yeah, how did he come up with that?
So, I mean, it's possible that Joffrey's involved in some way. I would want to know a lot more. I would want to know, like, what did he think he was going to get out of it? Did someone like Littlefinger whisper in his ear and say, you know what, you have to really impress your dad if you're going to, you know, impress your dad that this is a good mercy killing. Show your dad that you have the fortitude to make the strong manly decision or something like that.
I see. Does Robert say something about how Bran would be better off dead?
I think that he overhears Robert say that in company that includes Joffrey.
Okay, that makes
sense. He says something to the effect that, like, you know, yeah, it'd be better if the boy, you know, was dead instead of living his life as a cripple or something like that. So maybe Joffrey takes that and runs with it.
Yeah.
But Joffrey doesn't like brag about it to his dad, or, you know, there's nothing there.
Right.
I mean, I guess the deed isn't really done. Bran survives, but I just don't think, I really don't think Jaime has the right of this one.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone really knows how involved Joffrey was.
Yeah. I think it's odd that's the theory that Jaime comes up with. Especially from his perspective, it's like, it's what Bran knows about him and Cersei. That's
the clear motive. It's got to be someone who's trying to, it's either someone who's trying to protect Cersei and Jaime's secret, or it's someone that knows about Jaime and Cersei's secret and wants to make it look like they did it. And I think that could easily be Littlefinger.
Right. So I kind of forget. Do we never find out?
I think a lot of fans would be like, yeah, we found out in the Storm of Swords, Jaime says that Joffrey did it. And I think that's enough for a lot of folks. What I'm saying is that I don't think we ever found out.
Uh-huh.
I don't think we have ever found. I think that we found out what Jaime thinks.
Yeah. So we never found out. That is so funny.
I mean, I think that we assume, I mean, we find out it's not Tyrion. I mean, that's clear, right? They think it's Tyrion, right, and it's right. Not.
Right.
It's someone with this Valyrian steel dagger,
uh-huh,
which was probably in Tyrion's possession. So it would have had to have been someone somewhat close to Tyrion to actually get the dagger away from him.
I mean, Jaime's theory is especially implausible given that it wasn't even Joffrey. I mean, it was an assassin that, I mean, you would have to suppose Joffrey had hired this assassin.
Yeah, Joffrey that would hired be an assassin.
Unimpressive to Robert.
Joffrey hired an assassin. Okay, here's another part of motive. So we know that Joffrey has reason to hate his uncle, right?
Yeah.
All right, because all of the Joffrey slapping.
I guess so.
So he's thinking, I'm going to do this thing to impress my father, but I'm going to pin it on my uncle, who I just can't stand. So I'm going to take his knife, pay an assassin to do it. He clearly doesn't pay a very good assassin. So, yeah. I mean, that does make Joffrey a little bit more plausible.
How do we know that it wasn't Cersei?
I don't think that we actually know that. And that was the other thing I was thinking.
Because, I mean, it seems obviously to be Cersei to me. Like, if I didn't
She
have
has the most to lose by the secret coming out.
Yeah, and she hates Tyrion.
And she hates Tyrion, yeah.
I mean, really hates him, right?
And, right, no, I think, I mean, that would certainly be an option. That would certainly be an option.
It's funny that it never gets made, like, it never comes out very clearly.
So here's the other sort of cheat that I use sometimes when I'm having these conversations. Sometimes the cheat I use is that the only people that really know are Martin and whoever Martin's told.
Yeah, right.
And so if the showrunners want Littlefinger's arc to come to an end, mm-hmm, in a satisfying way, then they're going to ask, like, you know, what happens with Littlefinger? And Martin's probably going to tell them directly, well, you know, in the most simple terms. So that's what happens in the show. And and sometimes that's a little cheat I use. I'm thinking, well, then George gave the Weiss and Benioff the outline, and that was one of the plot points,
mm-hmm,
in the outline. Anyway, I don't know. It puzzles me that a lot of fans think that they've got this solved because of what Jaime says. I don't think we could trust Jaime.
Yeah, I don't think so either. In fact, I'll say, as far as I can tell, Cersei is the prime suspect.
Hey, notable introductions.
Yep.
So we meet Pycelle in the flesh. We hear about Norvos, and we sort of get a very detailed description of the links of Pycelle's chain. Notable book differences. I think that the biggest differences in this chapter from the show is that, number one, Renly is just a completely different, he's just cast in a different way in the show. He really comes across as someone who, like, just can't, you just can't imagine him on the battlefield. Whereas I think that this chapter is meant to make us think that he's sort of Robert Baratheon come again.
Yeah.
Littlefinger and Ned, like, they don't do the whole sort of climb down the rock face and ride to the brothel. It's kind of just like a, it's just like a more straightforward, like, sneak off to the brothel together. But, you know, a lot of the sort of the key points are the same.
One other question for you. Mm-hmm. I did notice Littlefinger, when he was talking about Varys, he said something like, if the pie is open, the birds begin to sing. You know, Varys wouldn't like that. That's a weird reference to a real nursery rhyme.
Oh, it is. I didn't recognize that.
Let me look it up real quick. Yeah. 4 and 20 blackbirds.
Baked in a pie, right?
That's right. Sing a Song of Sixpence is the name of the, I'm looking at Wikipedia here. Okay. So it says, sing a song of sixpence, a pocket full of rye, 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie. When the pie was opened, the birds began to sing. Wasn't that a dainty dish to set before the king? The king was in his counting house, counting out his money. The queen was in the parlor, eating bread and honey. The maid was in the garden, hanging out the clothes. When down came a blackbird and pecked off her nose. And shortly after that, there came a little wren, as she sat upon a chair and put it on again. So that's one version of it. I don't know if there's any significance to that.
Littlefinger actually say? Because it doesn't sound like a direct quotation.
He says, if the pie is opened, the birds begin to sing.
And is that a direct quote?
Well, when the pie was open, the birds began to sing.
Oh, all right. Yeah, that's certainly an allusion.
Yeah. And there's a counting house and a king and a queen. And I don't know what to make of it. Maybe nothing.
Huh. I don't know what to make of it either. It is a really weird thing to say. We know that Varys has little birds, right?
Yeah.
And the birds sing only to Varys.
Right.
And Varys wouldn't like it if the birds, you know, sung out for everyone.
Right.
Aside from that, I don't know what to make of that saying.
I guess it's also true. I was just reading, I guess they serve pigeon pie at certain wedding feasts.
So the other interpretation that I could come up with is 4 and 20. 4 and 20 could just mean marijuana. And so the pie could just be like an edible.
That's probably what it means.
I think we cracked it, man.
All right, sweet.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I jump into Season 3, Episode 1, Valar Duharis. This is the episode where John meets Mance Rayder and Danny's shopping around for an army. And we get one of these vintage exchanges between Tyrion and Tywin. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, as someone who has lost a nibble, do you feel a certain affinity for the Unsullied?
Yeah, that scene was... It was, yeah. At one point, I was like, don't worry, dude. It'll come back. Like, I wanted to comfort him. I know he probably wouldn't have cared because, you know.
He doesn't care about anything.
Clearly. No. But unless he already knows, it'll come back. I've seen this.
It happens every other week.
Well, because you got to figure there's a lot of these guys, and there's a reason they have them covered like that. I'm sure this is all part of the sales pitch, right? And everybody knows. It's just like, you know, it's like if you're selling Cutco knives, yeah, you're going to cut the penny with the scissors at some point, and that's going to be the thing that sells the rest of the knives. And that's the thing you're giving away with the knives. You know, I mean, that's the trick, right? I mean, you cut the nipple off after your whole presentation. Everybody's like, yeah. And then the nipple cuts off. Like, all right, how many of these are you selling?
This guy has no reaction.
None.
And it is the right nipple.
Mm-hmm.
This is the exact nipple that you lost.
It's like I was there.
And yet, for some reason, I think that maybe his stoicism was a little bit better than yours.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, that was a long period of just sort of wandering around with a flaky nipple in my hand in disbelief. It's like holding a mostly sucked on butter rum lifesaver, as I believe how I put it before.
So Danny's considering buying a slave army.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that you're trying to shop around for the best army.
Sure. Little Attack of the Clones-ish.
Yeah, it is a little bit. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. There's an assassination attempt on Danny's life.
But then Obi-Wan saves her.
He's an old guy, but clearly he's got some sort of love for the Targaryens. And he's maybe a little bit of, he wants to repay the Joffrey's dishonor.
Right, right.
You know, here's a guy, he's sworn to protect someone. He needs someone to protect. That's kind of who he is. So if he can't be in the employ of one king, he's got to go find a upstart queen, I suppose.
That's right. It's a startup.
We find out that Cersei tried to have her brother killed.
Right.
At least this is what Varys says. And I think that we're supposed to believe it.
Yeah, I kind of get that, right?
And she's like playing it off like, yeah, guess that happened. What are you going to do about it?
Right. Well, because it's a power move either way, right? Even if it isn't true, the fact that there's that level of suspicion does shift the balance of power, and it complicates their relationship to the point where it's like, yeah, you know, I went out of my way to do this. I could do it. I wouldn't be here if I did, you know? And so there is something about that. They just become... You know, more,
Well, they become equal.
Yeah.
I mean, before Tyrion had the upper hand, and she was sort of like, yeah, I can't really do anything about you shipping my daughter off. There's nothing really I can do besides keep secrets from you. And now it's clearly she's got the upper hand, I think.
This is the convergence that's eventually coming and trying to understand what, who's playing what. But that's the, it's kind of the theme, right? I mean, who's zooming who in this situation?
Steve, it's who's zooming whom, please.
I come from a different time.
You do. Yes. You've time traveled from the early 90s to this moment right now. Marjorie is good at politicking with the kids.
Right. Well, and this kind of goes, I mean, it was interesting because it does go back to a lot of what Tyrion was talking about before, like about how, you know, or not, was it Tyrion, or was it, who was he talking with about the, it's the poverty and the hunger that becomes the issue during the revolt. That was Bronn, right?
That's right.
There's an advantage to taking care of these folks. You can't just ignore the people.
Well, this is why Joffrey is just too stupid to live. He just has no idea that this is actually a good thing for him.
Right.
To actually play some politics and get his subjects to have a warm feeling for him.
Right. So now you have an added element, right, with Marjorie, right? Because she's calculated. She has a goal. You know, we talked before about how, like, Sansa, is she, you know, what's her motivation? Why does she continue to sort of play along? Why was she doing all that? Was it because there was just this young girl in her that still wanted to be mm-hmm. a queen? And which could be the case, but also it shows that, you know, she's looking at it from still a very romanticized view of what it means to be a queen, whereas Marjorie understands the game that goes along with it and what the role of the queen can be. And we haven't seen that really from anybody, with the exception maybe of Cersei.
Well, see, I was going to say, I think that what we're seeing here is sort of a dramatic pairing of Cersei and a younger version of Cersei.
Right. Which,
and in this episode, Joffrey even sort of calls out his mother's age.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, here's Marjorie, she's not going to be bullied in the same way that Sansa was.
Right. And she plays it real cool. I mean, she holds authority even when she defers. In a way, she's sort of firing shots right at Cersei, but having no fingerprints on the arrows.
Yeah. Yeah. She's good at this. And Cersei recognizes that.
Right. And Joffrey, who's just like, you know, he's regardless of what we've seen in the past, he's got a little bit of, he's a horny boy, but he also wants a queen that's like, that can be helpful, right? Like, not someone that he's necessarily been saddled with, but someone that he can be like, yeah, all right, let's do something. Let's get weird. John meets the king beyond the wall.
So this is a guy named Mance Rayder, who used to be a crow.
That's a whole back and forth. So I still think we're in the same spot where it's like, is this John shifting towards desertion of his post, or is this John still perhaps trying to, you know, continue the plot that Halfhand had in mind?
Well, okay, so like with any good undercover cop show, you know, the cop that's undercover, he's going to get a lot of the streets in him.
Yeah.
He's going to go native a little bit.
That's right. He's Donnie Brasco.
In fact, he's going to need to do that in order to be believable.
Right.
The people he's investigating. Now, with John, he's a little wild himself.
Sure.
This whole sort of system of patriarchy, and this hasn't really gone well for him. In addition to that, he seems to like one of these wildlings. I think he's...
Right,
he's in for Ygritte.
And he's got plausible deniability. If things got a little juicy between him, he could be like, I was undercover.
Okay, I think that the big takeaway from this episode, Steve, is the exchange between Tyrion and Tywin.
Oh, for sure. That's the big one.
Tyrion, in his father's eyes, is a creature of envy, lust, and low cunning.
Yeah.
And he will never be heir to Casterly Rock.
No, no. That's them's fighting words.
I mean, after everything that Tyrion did, man.
Well, and that's what makes it even like that scene becomes so like, whoa, because, you know, there was this sense of when he was named to the hand and we had this conversation back, you know, like there's still a sense of like, even then it wasn't like Tywin's like, you're my dog, you got this. But it was a certain sense of like, okay, look, I don't really want to do this, but this would mean an awful lot to you. And, you know, maybe you'd be good. It almost seemed like, you know, now when you look through that back and forth through this lens of this episode, it's kind of like, it felt more like, well, go ahead, be the hand. Like, there wasn't this level of maybe he really trusts him and saw something in him.
Well, earlier, the exchange that Tywin and Tyrion had previously was that, you know, he kept on saying, you're my son, you're a Lannister. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be Hand of the King. You're going to rule in King's Landing. It was almost like he had sort of risen to respect Tyrion. Now it's sort of revealed that, I mean, there was even a hint that he doesn't even really think that Tyrion's his son.
Right. Yeah, because at first I thought, like, when this back and forth was going, I'm like, okay, maybe Cersei poisoned the well. And it sounds like to a certain degree she did, right? Like, I mean, the reports of him just philandering and this and that. Yeah. And so it really just sort of negated anything that he made. Like, if he did do good stuff in the battle, it was almost like he crammed for the final. When in reality, I mean, like, in the exchange, it's like there was so much more that, I mean, Tyrion really kept that place, not just in the battle, but like all together, kept it from running absolutely amok.
Yeah, then Tywin shows up, and from his perspective, he's like, the battle was almost lost when I showed up, and you're just there, like, bleeding out on the battlefield. Clearly, you're not good at this.
Right.
And then I find out the one thing I told you not to do, you did, in bringing Shay to King's Landing.
Right, right.
So from his perspective, you had your shot. Clearly, you're not up for this. You're as disappointing as I thought you were initially.
Right. And just adding more and more and more insult to it, right? I mean, like, you know, you killed my wife, essentially.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
If there was ever a question about whether or not Tyrion and his father were going to be able to rebuild things, I think this episode ends that notion.
Well, because the sibling rivalry almost has baked into it father's approval. The fact that he sent Tyrion created at least the illusion to both of them, now that we've seen the reality, but like the illusion to both of them that he saw him in a new light. And that light could be as equals or maybe even as superior to Cersei. And that is a major shift given who he is in the family and all of that, right? So it's like, and now that's been stripped away. So
just, I get the sense that if he hadn't spent a few days unconscious, things could have gone differently. Like if, for instance, if the Hound didn't run away and the Hound could have led the battle, Tyrion could have like been conscious when his dad showed up.
Right.
Then Cersei wouldn't have had just total carte blanche to just say whatever she wanted. Things would have gone differently. But because of Tyrion's bravery, because he almost died on the battlefield, he didn't have the freedom to spin it in his direction.
Right. Or just lay out the facts.
Or just lay out the facts.
Like he had mentioned before, he says it's not slander if what we say is true.
So we met Lord of Bones.
Yeah.
And he
saw ourselves a real giant.
Saw ourselves a real giant. Add that to the list of magical stuff.
Yeah, no doubt.
What'd you think about the giant?
Surprisingly okay with it.
Really?
Yeah. I like the fact that he was fairly antisocial.
Yeah, yeah. In the book, I think that he calls John a little girl or something.
Ooh, I like that.
And he laughs at him.
I like a saucy giant.
I like a giant that doesn't need a hammer. He can just pound a tent stake into the ground with his fist.
Yeah.
That's what I expect out of my giant, Steve.
you're saving on supplies.
Okay, so then we meet Tormund Giants Bane.
Sure.
What do you think about that guy?
You know, typical ginger.
And then we meet Mance Rayder. This guy's got some charisma and he seems to be intelligent. And yet he seems to be all in on Jon joining the Night's Watch. Like, it might be more believable if he just killed Jon right there.
Yeah, I can see that.
Davos wakes up on an island.
Right. Very determined to bring Stannis back to reality.
Or at least kill Melisandre.
Right, sure.
You know, he's thinking, my son's dead. Someone's going to die. And we got to meet our little pirate again.
Yeah.
I love that little guy, man.
He's a fun, fun little fellow.
Salvador San is his name. And he's got a lot of good sense. He's got some great one-liners.
Yeah, he does, for sure.
And he just loves being a pirate.
That's his thing.
He may be the happiest man in Westeros. He knows what he wants. He doesn't want too much. He's pretty, you know, he's pretty happy with who he is. He's not going to play the Game of Thrones. He might try to get with Cersei every now and again, but I don't feel like he wants to force the issue.
No. He'd like to see it happen organically if it could.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to know that there is someone in Westeros that's just pretty content.
Yeah.
I wish all pirates were as happy and fun-loving as Salvador San.
Yeah, I think we're led to believe that as children.
Yeah. Pirates are very likable characters. Right.
Yeah, I mean, you'll dress your children up as them, right? But you won't, you know, you'll dress your child up as a pirate, but you wouldn't dress him up, say, as like Bill Cosby or Mike Tyson.
No, because that would be untasteful.
Right. Yeah.
So we've got a few different pairings. Now we have, you know, Arya's with Hot Pie and Gendry.
Gendry, yeah.
And
she's got a cheat code to get Jacken back.
Oh yeah.
She's got a new name.
That's right. She's got herself a coin and a little Valar Morghulis.
Yeah.
And then, so we have that. Jon and this king beyond the wall. That'll be interesting. Jon and Ygritte. That'll be interesting.
Well, there's, and then the Varys with what's her name is an interesting.
Roz. Varys and Roz.
Yeah, Varys and Roz set up a little alliance last go around. And now she's got a little double agent duty going on.
Now, the first time I watched this, I thought that they killed Roz. I thought that Joffrey killed both of the prostitutes.
Mm.
So I was kind of surprised to see her because she's not a book character. She's sort of an invention of the show. And I thought, well, she's kind of served her purpose.
Right.
And that was their way of like getting rid of her.
Then she stood in as the what they thought was going to be Shay.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. And so she's like her character. So she's been a good soldier, so to speak. And now it feels like she's been upgraded.
Oh, she's just a survivor.
Yeah.
Either she still has some love for Sansa, or she is a very good henchman for Littlefinger, who wants to get close to Sansa.
Right.
So Dany is in a city called Astapor, and her plot is going to revolve around these slaver cities in Essos. And we get to meet the Unsullied, the slave army, and figure out what Dany's going to do.
She's got a slave army and some dragons. That seems like that's helpful.
And she's got a scorpion killing old man now.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the thing. Is she got a, you know, she has, you know, which may complicate things in her little ranks, but
if there was some old man that wanted to follow me around and just kill scorpions, I'd be okay with it.
Yeah, no doubt. And he would only have to do the one, and I would always assume I need him.
You have a job for life, sir.
Yeah, I'm like, I didn't expect that one, so I don't expect another one.
You will always have bread at my table so far as you are able to kill all the scorpions in my path.
If you have a question or rebuke for Anthony or Steve, you can send that to book@baldmove.com.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'd like to read a few paragraphs from Caroline Larrington's book, Winter is Coming. Caroline is a medievalist at Oxford, and we're going to have her on the podcast coming up pretty shortly. This is a great book, Winter is Coming. It's put out by Bloomsbury. I'm going to read from pages 128 going forward. I'll skip a few paragraphs here and there. One enduring question about the finances of the Westerosi polity is quite how Peter Baelish, with his thriving brothel business, comes to be entrusted with financial responsibility. The answer lies in the past. Littlefinger embodies the kind of rising man who could take advantage of new opportunities for social mobility. In this respect, if not in most others, he's reminiscent of Chaucer. Chaucer's father and grandfather were both London wine merchants. The well-connected bourgeois family were able to place their son as a page in the house of the Countess of Ulster. Thus his royal connections began. Soon he was traveling to Europe with his noble masters, journeying as far as Italy and Spain on the king's business, and marrying one of the queen's ladies-in-waiting. Chaucer was appointed as comptroller or master of customs at the port of London, serving in that capacity for 12 years. In 1389, he was appointed clerk of the king's works, traveling far afield to oversee the king's building programs. The bourgeois young man ended his career in major, if not stellar, royal offices. These would have been reserved for nobility. Littlefinger is no Chaucer. As far as we know, at least, we don't see him working on his poetry in his private moments. Nevertheless, from relatively humble origins in the Fingers, a depressingly poor patch of land north of the Vale, from a house that can't even track its own maester, he has done extraordinarily well. Like the Chaucers, Littlefinger's fortunes thrive on social unrest. Here's a quote from a conversation between Littlefinger and Varys. Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. Many who try to climb it fail and never get to try again. The fall breaks them. And some are given a chance to climb. They cling to the realm or the gods or love. Only the ladder is real. The climb is all there is. Fostered at Riverrun with the more power and the better-born Tollys, Peter exploited Lysa Arryn's romantic obsession with him. John Arryn made him Master of Customs at Goldtown, the principal port of Vale, where his acumen increased income to the Vale 10 times over. This began his social ascent. So according to Larrington, who's an expert on the topic, there are a few more parallels here between Chaucer and Baelish than I had previously seen. And I appreciated those, and I'm going to be excited to have her on the pod in just a few weeks. I hope you are too.